Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
The anonymity of online spaces means that kids are coming across blatant racism while gaming and consuming social media. In today's episode, I'm talking with Dr. Rob Eshman about how this impacts young people of color and what parents can do to support kids who experience online racism. Welcome back to Project Parenthood. I'm your host, Dr. Nanika Kaur, clinical psychologist and respectful parenting therapist. Each week, I'll help you repair and deepen your parent-child connection, increase self-compassion and cooperation from your kids, and cultivate joy, peace, and resilience in your relationship with them. Rob Eshman is a writer, scholar, filmmaker, and educator from Chicago. He's an associate professor of social work and a member of the Data Science Institute at Columbia University, as well as faculty associate at Harvard's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society. He's also the author of the new book, When the Hood Comes Off, Racism and Resistance in the Digital Age, which examines how racism is manifesting online and also highlights the anti-racist strategies young people are using to resist and oppose it. Here's my chat with Dr. Eshman. Hi, everyone. I'm here now with writer, scholar, filmmaker, and educator, Dr. Rob Eshman. Dr. Eshman, I'm so glad to have you here at Project Parenthood to talk with us about the intersections of racism, social media, and youth well-being. Thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
It's really exciting to have you here. I really am interested in this topic. But before we jump in, can you just tell us a little bit about the work you do as a researcher and, you know, race, education, social media, resistance, all that stuff?
Yeah. So, you know, broadly speaking, I study Black freedom projects. And so I'm interested in understanding what oppression looks like. I'm interested in uncovering the mechanisms of racism and how they limit our opportunities and hurt our lives so that we can better fight against them. So that's what my work seeks to do. My book, When the Hood Comes Off, Racism and Resistance in the Digital Age, is a story about the ways that technology changes how we experience, understand, and respond to racism. You know, it's a data-driven book, but also a human-centered and story-driven book. You know, I have interviews with over 80 students in 5 different cities, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Chicago, Boston, and New York. And then I also draw on millions of tweets over a decade to look at trends and how folks are talking about race online. And, you know, and I think that I have a long history of doing work that is kind of community and education focused. And so I got into education to be, you know, to do work in education reform. And then I, you know, also have done a lot of work around social media and violence prevention. And so for a long time, I've been thinking about ways that we can improve youth access to education. And then also ways that we can use technology to, you know, strengthen the ways that social workers or violence prevention workers or community workers, activists are able to engage with young folks and working to, you know, increase the you know, their capacity to succeed.
Thank you. It's so like meaningful, the work that you're doing, and it's so needed, right? Like we're so in the situation right now, especially, I feel like, and, you know, we're going to talk about social media, but it does seem like we're in this particular climate right now where racism just seems like so much more rampant. I mean, it's always there, but it's just like all in your face in this moment, it feels like.
Absolutely. It does seem like folks are getting more comfortable being more open with their racism. And I think that is, you know, something that you can read more about in the book. But I do think that that has to do with you know, Trump built his base on social media. And then part of his claim to fame is not, you know, having this kind of kind, gentle way of talking about issues of race that hides the racism behind some conservative policies the way that, you know, many other conservative politicians might. And people like that. And that means now you have lots of Congress folks who are trying to do the same thing. They're trying to tap into that Trump base by showing that they're not scared to be open about some of these issues. Right? You look at what's happening with, you know, racial discussions being banned in schools and that, right? I think that they're worried. They're scared of the ways that we have been centering anti-blackness in a way that is waking folks up to how racism has been operating.
Absolutely. And so, speaking of young people, right? Like, what are some of the ways that young people are coming across online racism?
You know, there are so many ways. I think I open the book. So the beginning of chapter one, I tell a story of how the first time I was called the N-word was playing video games. And so I think that is one obvious place that kids may be exposed to these types of things, is that when you're gaming online and you know, you have a username that makes you feel anonymous, you don't feel like there are any real world consequences. You can't get in trouble from your parents or your principal or your employer when you're racist online. That is one place that kids get exposed to it a lot. I know with my own kids, I have been very careful in terms of how they engage in video games, that I make sure to go into the settings and make sure that they can only chat with their friends as opposed to being able to hear what anyone they might be playing with in the lobby has to say. But even with all those precautions that I take, as someone who's very familiar, right, with these spaces, my youngest told me about hearing racist language when he was playing on a VR headset that his older brother had bought. I had never used VR at that point, and so I didn't know how to go in there and change the settings. And so I talked to my oldest son about it. He figured out a way to get around it. And right, but these are things that happen even when we do, right, when we do what we're supposed to try and prevent it, it's still going to happen. So from video games to comments on YouTube videos to, you know, the content of other YouTube videos, right, that I think that racism is everywhere. The evidence seems to support the idea that when you spend a good amount of time online, you're going to run into people talking crazy.
Absolutely. And for students of color, that online racism, how is it impacting them?
So we have research that shows that experiences with online racism have similar negative effects as the experiences with face-to-face racism. So it increases symptoms of depression, increases symptoms of anxiety, increases stress. So these are things that are hurting our health. They're hurting our mental health. But beyond those kind of health effects, it has the ability to, or it has the potential to change the way we think about the world. So one of the chapters of When the Hood Comes Off, I do a case study of an anonymous website on a college campus where students were able to post messages without their names being attached. And it just turned into a safe place for racists to vent. And it was incredibly harmful for the young folks on that campus who realized that their peers had these negative things to say about them. So for some people, you know, one of the effects was that it changed their worldview, that they thought they were in a world that was post-racial. They thought that they were around people who are anti-racist. And then they began realizing that, no, racism is a bigger problem than I thought it was before seeing this racism online. You know, for other people, the effect may be that you lose your ability to feel safe, that if you know to avoid racists, when people microaggress you, you say, okay, that's fine. I won't be with you on the group project because I'll go someplace where I know that I'm wanted. And, you know, when it's coming from anonymous places, it makes you less trusting of people, right?
So I think they're coming from anywhere.
Exactly.
And, you know, one thing that is standing out to me also about what you're saying is seeing the online racism can bring about these negative health consequences. And some of those things that you were listing, depression, stress, anxiety, like, those are the ways that, you know, you might see a lot of young Black girls and boys and non-binary folks like behaving out from a place of anxiety, depression, stress. And like,
that's right.
And all of that like plays into the whole problem. Actually, it's like a cycle, a vicious cycle.
Exactly. No, that's exactly right. And I, and people may not recognize where those problems are from. And, you know, this is something else that, I know that this is a podcast about parenthood, and you're making me think about my own kids and conversations I have with them, where they've told me stories of students in their class who struggle with their behavior or who do things that they feel are mean all the time. And as they tell me these things, one thing that I want to talk to them about is you never know what someone is going through at home. And oftentimes those type of behaviors that you see in the school, that means that they are in pain. And so that I make sure that I want to tell my kids to treat those kids with kindness and not where you're coming back at them because, you know, they act in a certain way. So now, you know, they're being shunned or this or that. Is I want to make sure that my kids know that person is likely hurting. And so treat them as someone who needs, you know, your love and who needs some care. And so absolutely, I think that kids tend to have externalizing behaviors when they are dealing with depression or anxiety. And not everyone is equipped to recognize those things and to respond accordingly. That you may think, oh, this kid is right. And, you know, there's someone who's spent a lot of time working in schools. Oftentimes kids are labeled, oh, this kid is a knucklehead. They start problems. They want to fight all the time. And you don't realize that there is something that they need that they are not getting that is the explanation for that behavior. And so we don't want to be punitive with them. We need to find a way to get them the supports that they need in order to be happy and healthy, you know, while they're in that building and when they're at home.
Absolutely. And, you know, that same externalizing behavior is what feeds mm-hmm. that school to prison pipeline. People just label a child as a problem rather than a child who is hurting and begin to just punish everything.
Yes.
And not every student is treated that way, as we know.
That's right. That's right. I think that in better resourced schools, right? In white suburban schools, kids who have those same externalizing behaviors are not labeled problems the way that they might be in poor, lesser resource schools. And so when you have a social worker who can see the students who are acting up, then you have someone who, that is a resource that is allowing that student to get access to care that they need. And I think that so not to say that there aren't social workers and, you know, poor or black schools, but I think that oftentimes folks are overburdened.
Absolutely.
In schools that don't have as many resources. And so, yes, that there is a big difference in how kids are treated who exhibit the same behaviors based on the color of their skin.
Jake from State Farm here, hanging out with Mel's Mow and Grow. Mel chose State Farm for small business insurance because his local agent is a small business owner, too. So she knew how to help him personalize his policies. And now he's rolling in the green. Like a good neighbor. Guys, I'm trying to do the line.
Oh, sorry, Jake.
It's all good. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.
Making my cat happy is my number one priority. And Fresh Step Outstretch litter helps me do just that. Meet Mr. Mittens. Mitty, for short. Mitty is happiest when his litter box is clean and fresh, and Fresh Step Outstretch is amazing at absorbing waste and odor. We sure have found our common ground, haven't we? Happy cat, happy life. Find Fresh Step Outstretch at a store near you. Fresh Step is a registered trademark of the Clorox Pet Products Company. Certain trademarks used under license from the Procter & Gamble Company or its affiliates.
The days are officially getting longer, and while there may be a bit more daylight, do you still feel like there isn't enough time to do things like plan and shop for healthy meals? Hungry Root is your partner in healthy living. It's the easiest way to get fresh, high-quality groceries and simple, healthy recipes delivered to your door. Take a fun, short quiz, and Hungry Root will get to know your health goals, your tastes, the appliances you use, and more. Then, they'll build you a personalized cart with all your grocery needs for the week, along with delicious recipe recommendations to put those groceries to good use. Everything from Hungry Root follows a simple standard. It's got to taste good, be quick to make, and contain whole, trusted ingredients. Save hours planning, shopping, and cooking. Hungry Root delivers food you'll love. As a busy parent striving for healthier eating, Hungry Root has been a game changer for our family. Our box was filled with fresh, high-quality ingredients and simple recipes tailored to our tastes and preferences. One feature we particularly loved was the ability to customize our meals by swapping ingredients, making mealtime exciting and adaptable to our needs. Ordering was a breeze, and the convenience of having everything delivered to our door saved us valuable time. Hungry Root truly made our weekly meals easier and better, allowing us to enjoy nutritious and delicious dishes without the stress of planning and shopping. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Project Parenthood listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/parenthood to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/parenthood. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. You're talking about the negative mental health, negative consequences of this online racism. But how is it impacting not only just those students, but I'm just thinking about just society in a larger, broader way. How is all this online racism that you and I are seeing more of, everyone seeing more of, how is it affecting us in the way we're sort of interacting with each other?
Yeah, I think that it is waking us up. I think that it is, right? So the way I talk about it in the book is I talk about racism being masked behind friendly interactions or policies and laws that are not racist by the letter of the law, but are racist in their effects, right? And I think that racism is being unmasked in online spaces when it is revealing itself, right? I remember coming up having arguments with some of my white friends who did not believe that the police engaged in violence. Right. As someone who was growing up in a Black and Latinx neighborhood, this is something that we all knew was happening to people around us. Right. And so. Right. But if you don't see it, you may have an uncle who's a police officer and you say, hey, my uncle's a great person. Like, why are you saying negative things about the police? And for that person, it may take a video of seeing police violence for them to realize, oh, racism is real. Right. This does still happen. And that is a problem. And I don't want to live in a world where unarmed people get shot by the police because of the color of their skin. And so I think that it can wake people up to the problem, right? I'm thinking about other incidents where there's leaked audio of a judge using the N-word. And right, all of a sudden people are like, oh, maybe we need to review that judge's cases, right? We don't need to have that leaked audio for us to look at the data and know that Black people are over-sentenced for the same crimes. We don't need to have those leaks in order to know, right? I think that there are other examples of police posting racist things to Facebook and then it leaks and you're like, oh my goodness, there are racist cops in this county. We didn't need that to know. For the folks who know, we didn't need that to know that there are, different rates of folks being stopped by the police or charged by the police, but some people do. And I think that is what technology is doing. It is changing the national conversation. It is leading to kind of a mass awareness of more people understanding what racism looks like in 2023. And right, the more people that see it, the more people are going to want to fight against it.
Right.
And so I think that is one effect of there being more racism, is that racism is losing its invisibility. And its invisibility is one of its biggest, strongest, best weapons. And so I think we're in a moment of discomfort where we're seeing, folks in power be a little bit more open with their hate. And that's scary. That's like the pendulum is swinging, kind of in the wrong direction right now. But I think in the long term, that will lead to them, it's like racism shooting itself in the foot, that they're going to lose that invisibility. And then more people are going to see these racist policies for what they are.
Yeah. And, what you're doing, too, is reminding me that, while there's this negative part of this online racism and the negative impacts it can have on people, it also is sort of, as you're saying, unmasking something and really pulling back the curtain on something that, as we know, has always been there. And now people can really know where it is. Like that person, I don't believe in people being doxxed and all of that stuff, because that's dangerous. But I mean, in a general way, like people are being held to account, and I think
exactly.
that's really important. And so it is, so I like what you're saying, like that there's like a positive side that it's out in the open, easier to fight something you can see.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And to go back to the kind of the effects is that I have other students who told me that when they see online racism, they use it as evidence. And that they're able to prove to their friends who didn't think racism was real or as prevalent as they were trying to suggest it was. And they use the online things as evidence of, hey, here's proof of what I was talking about earlier. So let's not pretend that we're past this issue.
Absolutely. So what can we as adults, what can we do to sort of prepare kids for the racism they're going to run into online in these online spaces? Like, what do we do about that?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that we need to, in the same way we have to talk about the police, I think we need to have the talk about social media or, you know, spending time online, where kids need to know the type of ugliness that they have the potential of being exposed to in online spaces. There's research that shows that when we prepare kids for bias, that when they experience racism, it may not hurt as much. They're able to see that as being a problem of the world. That is not something, there is nothing wrong with you when that person mistreated you. There is something wrong with the person who said those things to you. And I think for me, that is what I want for my kids to know, is that there's no way I can insulate them from racism. They all know what racism is, but I want them to know that it is not their fault. And so I think that's what we as parents can do is build, you know, in our kids a healthy and positive understanding of what it means to be who they are. Whether that's being, you know, Black, being, you know, being from a group of color, and understanding that, hey, this means that there's a target on your back, but that does not mean that your life is going to be bad. It's not that being Black means that you're not going to be able to get a job. It means that there are people who don't want to give you a job. So again, I think that some people think that could be scary for kids. My own way of doing these things is I'm just open with them. I didn't have a kind of a curriculum for when I wanted to introduce these ideas. I just, you know, seek to keep an open relationship with them so that they ask me questions, that they bring me their concerns. And when they do, I answer questions honestly. And so, right, I think that all my kids, and they're, you know, I have a 16-year-old, 13-year-old, 11-year-old. And I think that they all have an understanding of, right, how racism is in the world. But I don't think that it is something that for them is depressing or makes them feel disempowered. I think it's the opposite, where that they right, I'm trying to raise them to be change agents and to be strong, Black folks who, you know, are confident in their ability to, you know, to do what they want in this world and to, you know, be part of a positive change in society.
And so important to prepare kids. And I really like what you're saying about really keeping that relationship with them so that you can be, that they will come to you for support. I talk about that all the time on this podcast. It's the idea about keeping the connection with your child strong so that when negative things occur with them, not only do they have some resilience based on your relationship, but they also, they're not resistant to coming to you and saying, hey, this was a problem, or this bothered me, or how can I deal with this situation? I've worked with many families where that is not the case, you know, that the parent is like, my kid doesn't tell me anything. I know that they're struggling. I don't know what's going on. But, you know, it's a long game, I feel like, you know, those deposits you make in the bank of like goodwill between you and your kid when they're like toddlers and all that stuff, it like will pay off, you know, later down the line.
Yeah. You know, you hope so. And I think that every child is different, and I've seen children go different ways. And I don't necessarily, you know, I think everyone struggles in a different way. I think kids are resilient to, you know, for the most part, that kids are able to bounce back and to struggle through difficult situations. But yeah, that is the most any of us can do, is to keep a positive relationship with them so that when unpredictable or negative things happen, that they know that you are there in their corner, that you're going to, you know, support them. And I, you know, no matter what, I tell my kids all the time, no matter what mistake you make, no matter what happens, I'm always going to be on your team. I'm never going to be right on the side of trying to bring you down. That my goal will always be to boost you up.
I love that. I feel so lucky. They're so lucky to have you. So wonderful. But I mean, that's such a wonderful sentiment. I mean, I've so many adults that I know would have loved to have heard that growing up. You know, I think it's like a really, really important message to give to your kids.
Yeah.
So what are some ways that we can all sort of resist online racism, and specifically young people? How can they resist these things when they come across them?
You know, I think young people are doing it better than we are, to be honest. And that's something that, I started this study, started this book project, trying to understand how, racism looks different online, right? And I was surprised to find that the story I'm more interested in telling is how resistance looks different online. And this is not what I went into the study to find, but it's something that came out of the data where, right, young folks of color, in particular, are using digital tools in order to challenge racism in ways that is abnormal in face-to-face settings. And so just to give an example here, right, that the, you know, one of the more common ways that we experience racism, at least interpersonally, is through racial microaggressions, which are racial slights, right? The everyday subtle insults that question the behavior or the appearance of people of color. And the research says that in face-to-face settings, the most common way to respond to microaggressions is just to not respond. That in most instances, we let those things go. We may talk about them with our friends or family later on, but we don't, you know, say anything in that moment, that it doesn't feel safe to do that. You think you might lose friends, might lose a job. You don't know what to say. You need to process it before you decide that it was about race and not about some other variable. Like I read, I think that some folks say, oh, you're too quick to jump to racism. I don't know any Black people that are too quick to jump to racism. We hope it's something that's not racism. And we look for every other potential variable it could be before we say, oh, all right, that was racist. And I think that is the reality, and that keeps us quiet, right? So that folks of color often feel silenced when they experience racism or microaggressions. And online, there's a very different dynamic. I had a student that told me where he was talking about a racist joke that a white student made online. He said, there's never been an instance when no one responded to a comment like that, where it was the norm for there to be someone who sees this public comment made that they are always going to see someone had the energy to clap back that day and to respond to that comment and say, hey, this is problematic and here's why. And I think that is, you know, can be empowering for people to see racism be challenged in that way. So for us to recognize that, hey, racism is a problem, and I'm glad that someone is dealing with it. Even if I didn't have the energy or the time or feel like I had the capacity to respond to that comment, someone else did. And that is stopping the reproduction of racism. It is stopping the ways that silence empowers racists, because they're never told that what they're doing is wrong. And so that would be my advice, is to, if you have the energy, that when you challenge racism, when you respond to people who say or do racist things, that you are, you know, being a part of the solution. But then I do want to give the caveat that everyone does not have energy to do that, and that is okay. For some people, resistance might mean healing and taking the space to step away from conflict. And I think that I fully respect that. And I want to honor that everyone does not have the capacity to clap back every time that they hear or experience something racist.
I mean, somebody needs to pay you for that. That's like a job right there. Mm-hmm. That's like, you would not be able to like sustain that kind of energy over time.
Yeah. That's something that I found, is that a lot of the young folks who engage with these things the most see that as being part of their identity, that they are activists. And that is part of their activism. Mm. So they are intentional about those acts. And right, that may not be for everyone, right. but when you do it, it is having a big impact.
It's a huge impact. I'm thinking about what you said earlier about the ways in which, you know, you're anonymous online, and that can work in one's favor on the resisting racism side too, because somebody who may feel less safe to say something face to face might feel much more able to express what they really feel about this thing that happened, and someone else sees that and knows, like, I've felt that same way, right? Like, it just resonates with people, and people can get a glimpse of like what this does to people, you know, how it impacts people, and, you know, the hurt it causes.
That's right.
So, you know, as we're coming to the end of our time together, what's your advice just overall for kids who are, you know, dealing with social media and their whole lives are so digital, young people, and what should they keep in mind just overall, you know, and how can we as parents just be sort of supporters of this whole idea that, you know, we're surrounded by the online racism, but we can also stand against it?
Yeah. You know, I think for parents, it's all about, you know, what we've been talking about, which is maintaining that openness with them and not being punitive. And right, I think that we may have a first instinct, or some people may have a first instinct to punish kids when they do something wrong. And I think that kids may be nervous to tell their parents about what they saw on the internet because they know that it's bad and they don't want their parents to know that they were in that space. And I think when parents hear about those things, those are the moments where it's important to, instead of being punitive, to be supportive and to help them process what they saw. And the reality is, we are not able to control what our kids are going to be exposed to. And just to give an example of that, I worked in a, you know, in an elementary school, Chicago Public Schools, And on the school computers, you weren't allowed to go to YouTube. You weren't allowed to go to Facebook. You weren't allowed to play games. But these kids were on YouTube and on Facebook and playing games.
Indeed.
And I was asking them, you know, I wanted to go to YouTube on my break too. So I'm like, how did y'all do that? How did you guys get around this system? And they, you know, had figured out ways to use free VPNs and mirrored websites to bounce all around all these professional IT things that were meant to keep them off of certain sites. Mm-mm. Kids are brilliant and they are going to find a way to do what they want. And I think that that means we should not expend our energy just trying to keep them away from things we don't want them to see, but and spend more of our energy to build a relationship so that they know that when they see certain things that they need to come talk to you about that and how to process that. So that I think that is my best advice. And then for young people to know, I know that young people are, you know, speaking directly to young people here, that I think that young folks are spending a lot of time in unmoderated spaces. There are not adults there. There aren't authority figures or there's no institution that's protecting you in many online spaces. And to know that when you encounter things that make you feel uneasy, to talk to an adult that you trust about what you've experienced, that you don't have to navigate that by yourself. And that, right, that there are people who care for you who don't want you to have to figure out the, you know, the ugliness of the, you know, how the world can be ugly sometimes on your own, right? That there are people who want to support you.
Absolutely. And I think that what you're saying about not being a punitive parent is really important in that exact respect. If they're feeling uneasy about something, if something has disturbed them, distressed them, that's when they need us the most. And if they don't feel like they're going to be able to come to us without getting in trouble, then they will just try to handle those things on their own or with their, you know, similarly underdeveloped brained friends, you know, like that's, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's like they need us, so like what you're saying, an authority figure, someone who can like help, support, guide, and they don't really avail themselves of that support if they don't trust you.
That's right. Yeah. No, you've got it exactly right. And look, that, you know, that is what I'm doing the best that I can to do, but I make mistakes and learn every day. And so this is all, this is the journey for all of us.
That's right. Work in progress, all of us. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. And I've learned a lot and it's really interesting. And I'm really interested about your book. Tell us a little bit more about where we can find your book and your links and things like that. How can people get in touch with you?
Yeah. So When the Hood Comes Off is available everywhere books are sold. You can get it from Amazon. You can order it from Barnes & Noble. You can get it from your local bookstore. If it's not in stock, you can ask them to order it and it should be there in a couple of days. And then you can follow me. I have a website, robeshman.com. I'm also on Twitter at robeshman, on Instagram at rob.eshman. So yeah, feel free to be in touch.
Okay. We will put all of those things in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with us. And I hope to talk to you again another time.
Yeah. Me too. Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
That's all for today's episode of Project Parenthood. Thanks for listening. And I hope you found this helpful. Be sure to join me live on Instagram at BK Parents on Monday, November 13 at 12:45 p.m. when you can ask me anything. You can get your questions answered in real time. If you have a question for me about parent-child relationships, respectful parenting tips, and/or parental mental health that you'd like me to cover in a future episode, shoot me an email at parenthood@quickanddirtytips.com. Leave a message at 646-926-3243, or leave a message on Instagram at BK Parents. And you can learn about my private practice working with parents living in New York State at www.brooklynparenttherapy.com. Catch you next week. Project Parenthood is a Quick and Dirty Tips podcast. It's audio engineered by Dan Firebend. Our podcast and advertising operations specialist is Morgan Christensen. Our digital operations specialist is Holly Hutchings. And our marketing and publicity associate is Davina Tomlin. See you next week.
I know how to run a hair salon, but for small business insurance, I chose my State Farm agent. She's a small business owner too, so she knew how to help me personalize my policies. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to an agent today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.